Test 1, 2, 3. Test 1, 2, 3. Hello, hello, hello. Test 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. As I record, it is Friday, February 21st, 2014, a little before 18 UTC. I'm Sam Minter, and there's no Yvonne today. This week, it's my fault. Our normal recording time happened to be on the evening of my wife's birthday, so I pushed it off to later in the week, and, you know, by the way, happy birthday to Brandy, my wife, although she never listens to these shows. Then it turned out that the time we'd rescheduled for overlapped with an information session that I had related to possibilities for Alex's school. Not for any time soon, but potentially for things years down the road. And which, by the way, I just want to say, it is absolutely ridiculous that you have to think about these things so far in advance, because they're, you know, they're just all kinds of things that, like, well, they might fill up, and they have their waiting lists, and then there are lotteries, and then there's this, and then there's that, and you have to worry about, like, his birthday is 12 days before the cutoff, so, you know, he might need to be up a grade from where he nominally is from his age, and if that's true, then there's special stuff you have to do, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, you have to learn about this stuff way in advance to make sure you don't get screwed by any deadlines or anything like that. Anyway, I had to cancel again, and by that time, it was too late in the weeks to schedule anything else or to work out a co-host or anything. So here I am, recording a solo show on Friday. You know, I was taking a half day from work today anyway for some other things, but I'm using some of the time to do this, and I don't know. We'll see how the day goes. I may end up taking a whole day off because I got some other stuff to do too. But anyway, I say anyway a lot. You know, when I do these solo shows, I often start out by saying, it's going to be a short show, because it's just me and I don't have that much to talk about, and then the show ends up going close to an hour anyway. So I'm not going to say any of that stuff, and I'll just get on with things. I know that some of you aren't really fans of the solo shows. So if that's the case, just hit stop now. Don't frustrate yourself. Hit stop. Tune in again next week. And if all goes well, we'll have a normal full-blown show. One other thing before I get to, like, topics and what we're going to talk about today is just, I just want to say, I've noticed in the last few weeks, the sound quality has been kind of crap, and I apologize for that, and I realized a few minutes ago sort of what I was doing wrong. I changed the way that I normalize the volume on these things, and I was basically normalizing it to a level that was too hot, so there was clipping and stuff like that. I'm not going to have the time to go back to the old shows and fix them. I mean, because, you know, we have few enough listeners to the new shows. I mean, the number of people who go back to listen to old shows has got to be minuscule. So if existent at all. So I'm not going to bother and go back and correct the old shows, but I think I've adjusted it so we won't have that clipping. And for those of you who don't know, the clipping is sort of manifests itself as sort of a little digital buzzing when people are talking, especially when they raise their voices. So I think I've adjusted that so we shouldn't have that problem anymore. So apologies for the previous shows, because I switched from one method of normalizing the volume. You don't care, do you? I have several things. I run everything through something called a levelator that levels things throughout a particular clip. So it's even within, like, you know, if there's a loud part and then a soft part and then a loud part, and then, or if you've got two people talking and one of them's louder and one of them's softer, it's sort of tries to fix all of that. But then that doesn't make sure that the talking is the same volumes as the commercials, those stupid little breaks I put in, or that one segment is the same level as another. So I do another round of leveling to put everything at a good level. And for a while, I'd been using one technique, but it seemed like it always made things too soft because it was normalizing them to the maximum volume, the total maximum volume anywhere in the thing. So if any time anybody yelled, everything else would go lower in volume. Then I switched to an RMS technique, but I was leveling the RMS I was using the RMS, which is probably the right way to go, but I was putting it at too high volume to start with. So anyway, yeah, like I said, you don't care. So topics. We're going to talk about the Facebook and WhatsApp and all that kind of stuff. I'll do the proposed cable company mergers. A little bit about the unrest in several countries in the last couple weeks. And who knows, maybe I'll mention a little bit about the changes in late night TV. Although it's not really about, you know, Leno, Fallon. It's not like I watch either one of them. And maybe I'll do a little bit of an update on where we're going, where I am, excuse me, on planning for my 2016 poll analysis stuff. And first, I'll start on a little bit about projector screens, but let's just jump right into projector screens. So those of you who follow me on Twitter know, you know, we had an incident with our projector screen this week. So I'll talk a little bit about that. But first of all, we have a projector screen as our primary television, not a regular like flat panel TV that you go out and buy. And this has been the case for, I don't know, almost 10 years now. No, over 10 years now. At some point, instead of getting a TV, I got a projector and have been that way ever since. It takes a little bit more equipment to do it right, because you have to deal with the sound separately. But all in all, look, I would argue that you're better off with a projector in most cases. Modern day, there used to be a big problem with these things weren't bright enough to see unless you closed all the windows and made it really dark. That's really not the case anymore. They've got really bright ones. The prices are, you know, you can get a good 1080p projector for under $1,000. If you want to go all out and have, you know, you can spend tens of thousands on these things, but there's really no reason to, unless you're really setting up something, you know, incredible. That's cheaper than lots of regular TVs, or it's at least in the same ballpark, and certainly you get a much bigger size. Ours covers essentially a wall. You could argue that it's even too big, but you can always adjust it to make it smaller. Because you can adjust it, you know, you turn the little dial and you make it bigger or smaller and you make it the size you want. We've always had it set up essentially to cover a wall of our living room. If you have a blank wall, you don't even need a screen or anything. You just, as long as the color of the wall is basically a white or off-white or that kind of thing, you can do very well just projecting straight onto the wall. For those who are sticklers about exact color, you want to get a specific color white, and they make specific paints that are really good as projection surfaces, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you don't need all that crap either. You know, it works quite well as long as your wall is, you know, basic, you know, white or off-white color, you're fine. In our current house, we didn't have a wall like that, though, at least not in the living room. We have walls like that in a couple of the bedrooms, but we wanted to set it up in the living room. So we did get a projection screen. For a manual screen, you're running... Yeah, depending on the size, but you can get a really huge one for, you know, a couple $100. And we hung ours from the ceiling. We did so, following the instructions in the thing. We didn't hook it directly to the ceiling. I forget exactly our reasons. There are a couple modes. You can hook it directly to the ceiling. You can hook it to a wall. You can hang it from chains from the ceiling. For whatever reason, we ended up with the hanging from chains from the ceiling option. And we did all kinds of, you know, we checked to make sure it was really sturdy. You know, we pulled on the screen, We took the screen and pulled it down and let it retract violently. Like it, you know, it's a, that we got a manual strength screen at first, because we were, worried that, you know, Alex was just going to write on it or something and it would be ruined and we'd have to buy a new one anyway. So we should go for a cheaper option. But you know, it's spring loaded. So you pull it down and it goes whoop and slides up. So we did that a few times, made sure it was there, made sure we pulled on it, blah, blah, blah. And it was pretty solid. So we were pretty, you know, confident that, hey, that's okay. Well, the, last week, 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, Alex had put up the screen. He was doing something behind the screen, so he'd put it up, and that's fine. And you know, but we wanted him to, pull it back down because we were ready to use it for something. And rather than do it myself for whatever reason, I went ahead and asked Alex if he could do it. And so he pulled it down, but then it wasn't quite at the right place. It wasn't. So he was trying to adjust it and he was pulling it up and down. And at one point, as he was trying to adjust it, he accidentally let go and it did that retract up thing. But unlike other times, for some, who knows? Because like I said, we'd tested this many times. We'd done it many times without a problem. This time, for whatever reason, it was a little bit more violent than usual. Maybe it was a little off center. Who knows? And it went whoop back up. And the projector, the screen part that it rolls up into jumped. And the whole thing came off the hook. It was, you know, it's hanging by two hooks, one on each side. One of the sides came off the hook and it fell. And it fell down. It missed Alex by inches. It crushed a cheap piece of IKEA furniture that we had under there to just put, you know, the center speaker on. The other side didn't fall, very luckily. Let's put it this way. If any number of things had been slightly different, it could have hit Alex. And this thing, it's like, you know, 20 pounds something falling from 10 feet up. That could be significant. Let's say if it had hit him, at the very least, we would have been in the emergency room. And it could have possibly have been much worse. It was very, very scary. It landed in such a way that it was, you know, because only one end fell. The one end had fallen on the ground. The middle of it was sort of an inch or two over his shoulder. And then the other end was still hanging up. Like I said, it was very scary. My wife actually asked me, like, a half hour later, you know, she just wanted to make sure she hadn't had a psychotic break and actually Alex had been crushed and killed and her mind was playing tricks on her to make it so she wasn't recognizing that reality. Luckily, nothing like that happened. There was not a scratch on Alex. He was just a little bit scared by all the loud noise of this thing falling and crushing the little piece of cheap furniture. But he was absolutely fine. But scared the crap out of us. And so we did order a new one. There was a brief discussion of what we should do and blah, blah, blah. But, we decided very quickly that A, we did want to replace the screen, but B, we weren't going to get the same kind again. We were going to mount it straight to the ceiling next time. And also, we were not going to get the spring-loaded kind. Even though it was cheaper, we were going to get the kind that has a motor, and you push a button and it goes up or down slowly, depending. It costs almost three times as much at this size. It depends on the size. There's, if you get smaller ones, they're not much more expensive at all. But at the size we were getting, it's almost three times more expensive. But we didn't want that spring-loaded thing again because that was the proximate cause of here. We did the spring-loading thing happened. It went up violently and all kinds of forces went crazy. And again, I don't know exactly what was different about this time than any of the other times that that's happened, but, you know, luck of the draw, I guess. In any case, we ordered the new one, and they didn't have it at exactly the same size, so we actually had to get a couple inches larger. Oh, well. We could have gotten a few inches smaller as well, but we didn't want to go smaller. We were already used to the size we had, you know? Anyway, we ordered a new one, and we will be mounting it straight to the ceiling, and we will be doing extra checks on how stable the stupid thing is. But the fact that it won't have that spring-loaded thing will also make it a lot easier. And I mentioned a button to push it up or down. More to the point, there's a cable that you can hook directly to the projector so that it'll go down when you turn the projector on and up when you turn the projector off, which will actually be a lot better because we were just leaving the thing down essentially all the time because it was a pain in the ass to pull it down and get it to exactly the right place so that it framed the picture correctly. So this is better because then when we're not using the projector, which is actually a decent percentage of the time, you know, it's open and we see the windows and sunlight comes in and all kinds of good things. So this will be good. But I wasn't even going to mention this about the projector screen because I'd already tweeted about it, except for one additional thing that happened yesterday. The new screen arrived. And we bought it through Amazon, but it wasn't through Amazon themselves. It was through a third-party seller, and I forget their name, and I wouldn't mention them anyway. But they had it delivered by one of the smaller delivery companies, because this thing is huge when it comes in a box. It's like a 15-foot-long tube that arrives, essentially. And so it didn't just come UPS. They sent it through some other service, and I also am not going to mention the name here. But this was the worst delivery I have ever seen. I don't know. Maybe there's some competition here. But first of all, they wanted you to be here to receive it. They don't want to just leave a huge 15-foot-long tube on your porch or whatever, especially, you know, it's been raining here in Seattle. So they say that, when we first ordered it, they said they would call to arrange a delivery time and that we would have to be there and we would actually have to remove it from the truck ourselves. I'm like, okay, that's a little bit strange, but whatever. Then yesterday, and they said the target delivery date was the earliest possible it would be here is like February 5th and February 25th. And then it had a huge range, like through like March 10th or something, like a big range of time. But then yesterday, on February 20th, we got an email saying they're coming today. I guess it was actually the night of the 19th local time. But they said, you know, coming tomorrow, we'll be there between noon and four, and we will call half an hour before we arrive. Fine, whatever. This time they said, by the way, that they would put it in the first dry location, whether that's your porch or your entryway or whatever. So none of this, we have to pick it up ourselves on the truck. Okay, contradictory information, but okay, fine, whatever, it's better. I actually took a half day from work because I wanted to be here. The idea was, okay, it's coming between noon and four. We'll get it. We'll immediately open it up, hang the thing up. We'll do everything right then and there. So there's no delay on this. And also I wanted to get, you know, the place a little bit clean if they were bringing it into the entryway, just a little cleanup stuff. Cause you know, frankly, we're overworked here. The place is usually a complete and total horrible sty unless we're preparing for visitors, which luckily my mom lives here now and she comes by every Sunday for dinner. So we have to clean at least once a week. So it's much better than it was, but it's still like, okay, fine, whatever. Anyway. So fine. I took the time off. We cleaned, we did some stuff. 4 o'clock comes around, they still haven't called. They end up calling us at about 4:30-ish to tell us that they'll be here in 15 to 20 minutes. 35 minutes later, they actually arrive. And I'm waiting out. We have a flag lot, so it's easy to miss us on the street. So I'm actually waiting by the street. I see a truck go by. By the way, completely unlabeled truck, which obviously used to be a U-Haul truck because it's painted in U-Haul colors, but they've painted out U-Haul logos and stuff, so it's just white. But it's white and orange like a U-Haul truck. No other labels, no other anything. And they drive right past me. Then they turn around and they're slowly driving down the street. They're clearly looking for the address. I'm waving at them. They eventually see me. They come up. They roll down the window and ask if it's the right place. Now, I'll mention also that, you know, the person talking also had a heavy foreign accent, Eastern European probably, which, you know, no big deal. I'm no problem with foreign accents, but there was a language issue too. Like, it was clear, like, he wasn't, it didn't seem like he was a fluent English speaker. He was having a little bit of trouble communicating, but okay, whatever. He found the place. He did the thing. Okay. So they park. Now we have a driveway, like the natural thing if you're delivering a big box, back down the driveway and you do it there. But no, they parked on the street, sort of blocking our driveway. Whatever. It just means they have further to carry the box, I thought, but a little bit strange. Whatever. But then they opened up the back of the truck. And I was there standing, so I got to see this. If I'd waited at the house, I wouldn't have seen anything like this. But they opened up the back of the truck. This is not like a UPS truck with lots of small packages. Most of what they're delivering are larger things. Everything inside the truck had collapsed. Boxes were strewn everywhere. There was a big thing on a pallet. A big wooden pallet with some large thing on it. Looked like a piece of furniture, like refrigerator sized, or if it wasn't a refrigerator, maybe like a chest of drawers or something like a large thing, like 5 or 6 feet tall, big, at a 45 degree angle on its side. There were other boxes just like behind that thing that it had obviously fallen on that looked like they were at least somewhat smushed. There was, another huge, large box that was also all a kilter. They pulled that out. It looked like it was mostly empty, but maybe not quite. So maybe it had been something they delivered earlier and it only had the packing material in it. But it was they pulled that out. And then the two of them started rummaging through all these packages in the truck that were just, again, just completely randomly strewn everywhere because obviously nothing had been tied down or secured inside the truck, and all of these big, heavy packages had just been tumbling all over the place as they drove around the city. And so then they come out after rumbling around and speaking in a language I didn't understand for a while and sort of yelling at each other a few times. The man comes out with a big box that's like, you know, a 3 foot on a side cube. And he's like, is this your package? My package was not a 3 foot on a side cube. My package is a 15 foot long tube that's maybe 6 inches in diameter. I'm like, no, that's not me. I'm looking for a big, long, thin thing. So they went back and rummaged through their truck again for a while. And they eventually found my package. Now, at this point, I'm, of course, worried that it's crushed. It's whatever. And they pull it out. The ends are a bit smushed of the package, but it looks like it's fairly well packaged. And I'll be honest, I don't know the end to this story yet. We haven't opened it yet because by the time they actually got here, got everything unpacked, it was time for us to go to the evening thing with Alex school information that I mentioned earlier. So we haven't actually opened the box yet, but I took all kinds of pictures and, you know, the guy carries it to our front door and then is like, you have to sign paper. And he's looking for the paper. And meanwhile, he's half dropping the thing and he's looking for the paper. It turns out he doesn't have it. It's still in the truck. And he's like, you know, can you go tell the other guy I need the paper? And we're like, we're going to watch you carry this in. Anyway, I took lots of pictures of this. It was unbelievable. Like you expect, and this, again, this was not one of the major, you know, this was not UPS or FedEx or, you know, the major companies that we've all heard of. This was a little rinky-dinky delivery outfit, obviously. But they've delivered to us before, but never like this. And it's like, you gotta be out of your mind. Like, there are certain basics about, like, transporting things in trucks and delivering them that include, like, securing your load so when you go around corners, everything doesn't fall over and crush the other things. So I don't know if the next people who are getting stuff delivered got damaged goods or not. I don't know if ours is damaged or not. We inspected the package a little bit. It looks like it's fairly securely packaged, and it's not obviously, like, bent in half or anything, which if that big thing had fallen on it, could easily have happened. Crazy. Anyway, that's it. Oh, and by the way, part of the reasons we bought the new one was, of course, A, we're no longer confident in the security of the one we had, but also the one we had was kind of totaled. It was like when it fell and crushed that other piece of furniture, it was heavily bent. The things on the end that you hang it by were twisted. We weren't going to hang that thing back up again. It's currently in our garage because it's like, okay, how do we throw this thing out too? But anyway. Oh, I don't know. I just wanted to talk about that because, A, you know, really scared to death because this thing, you know, almost fell on Alex. And B, oh my God, I can't believe this delivery. We'll be back after this and we'll talk a little bit about mergers and acquisitions, Venezuela, Thailand, Ukraine, all of these places. I'll warn you on all of these, I'm not going to be talking so much about the specifics, but more higher level stuff, I guess. Anyway, let's take a break. Back after this. Okay, here we go again. And, after that, recording that last segment, I fiddled around even more with the sound settings. I think I've got a setup now that is working pretty good, at least when I'm recording straight into the audio program, which is a little different than when we record Skype with Yvonne. So, it sounded pretty good. I just went back and listened to it and, you know, none of the clipping and level volume. Anyway, hopefully it's better than the last few weeks, which have been awful. I know it's been awful ever since I switched that thing. It's all a matter of, like, you know, ever since I switched from GarageBand to Amadeus Pro, because GarageBand, like, sort of screwed up a bunch of stuff, so it doesn't work for me anymore with the latest update. I've figured it all out again in terms of this. So I apologize again if we had bad sound quality the last few weeks. Anyway, here we are. I was going to talk about Comcast and Time Warner and potential merger there. Now, obviously, you know, if Yvonne was here, he'd have, you know, some additional thoughts on the business side of this thing. That's his thing. I'm going to come in from a couple different perspectives, though. People have been talking about this being anti-competitive, even though Time Warner and Comcast don't service the same areas. So they weren't directly competing each other that way. So you're not reducing competition that way. But they talk about the balance of power between them and content providers in terms of being able to put pressure on folks like Netflix. I think it's a real issue. I mean, look, here's one of the things that puts me apart. I've always said I have libertarian tendencies, but at least in recent years, I haven't said I'm actually a libertarian. And the reason is because I'm not just suspicious of big government. I am suspicious of big government. I think in general, things should be decided at the lowest level possible. But, you know, one difference with libertarians is there are some things that I think absolutely probably should be decided at the national level. Some things maybe even should be decided at the global level. I have no inherent problem against that if it's done in a fair way. And some things might need to be in order to be efficient. I'm not, like, fundamentally opposed to government per se. I just am suspicious of concentrations of power, so therefore I want to devolve power as much as possible and make decisions locally whenever practical, which isn't the same as saying never make local decisions at a national level, and it isn't saying never have a big government bureaucracy for something. It's just only when you really need to. And I acknowledge the fact that sometimes you may really need to. It's not a never kind of thing. But the other difference is I care just as much about concentration of power in private entities. It's not just government I worry about. I worry about big corporations. I worry about, there were a number of articles this week. I tweeted one of them where someone's saying, hey, you know, all of you people who are worried about the NSA and their spying, why aren't you saying a damn thing about all of these things that corporations are doing along the same lines? And they mention, Google doing various things. They mention some terms of service. I think it was Verizon, one of the other telcos that are quite onerous. All of these guys are collecting all kinds of information. Of course, from the person it was coming from, the argument is somewhat along the lines of, it's couched as, why aren't you guys consistent? But the conclusion you're supposed to take from it, I think, is more, you shouldn't be as worried about the government as you are because, look, you're not worried about these other things. But the message I get out of it is I'm damn right to be worried about the government, but we should be just as worried about these other things. And the fact that they're not getting the same attention is itself a problem. We should be talking just as much about, the Experian or however you say their name of the world, the people who collect, your credit information or other information about you. Anyway, my point is just, I don't like big corporations just as much as I don't like big government. I don't think there's a fundamental difference there. Yes, the government can use guns and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that is a difference. But the reality is, various private organizations have just as much influence over your life and the quality of your life, and their choices can be just as significant. So I think they're important too. And that's where you get to, the big mergers of the cable companies and such. I think this is fundamentally an industry that in its current state is broken. And there are a couple of things here. One is, of course, they're known for horrible, horrible customer service. And in fact, the reality is there isn't much competition, not because there aren't a bunch of cable companies and mergers will make them even less, but because they're incredibly high barriers to entry. And many of those are, in fact, government imposed, where local monopolies are granted on cable service. So this town has Comcast, this town has Time Warner, this town has something else. And you very often, in most places, have very few options when it comes to delivery of cable and delivery of internet. Or I should say delivery. There are three major. It's delivery of television type programming. It's delivery of internet, and in some cases, delivery of telecom services as well. And so, solution number one here is actually open things up to more competition. These local monopolies are crazy. Now, I realize there's physical infrastructure of laying cables and cords and all of this kind of stuff that is intensive, and you still have high barriers to entry there anyway. But the way government has regulated this to date actually makes this worse. There are companies that would step up and compete. Like, God knows, everybody complains about their cable company. If it was fairly easy for a new player to come in and say, hey, I'm providing cable in this town too, come buy my stuff, then I think you'd see a lot of that get better very fast. The other dynamic here is the one that's been brought up that I mentioned earlier about the balance between essentially the providers of the pipes and the providers of content. If there's, they want Netflix to pay extra in order to have their content delivered. And this is where all those net neutrality debates come in. There have already been reports over the last couple months since that net neutrality ruling that in a number of big markets, Netflix quality has been declining dramatically. And it's almost certainly because the cable companies have been throttling them as part of trying to get them to pay up and doing other things. And not all of this is out in the open, so there's some speculation here, obviously, but you're seeing this already. And I think this is another place where you have major conflicts of interest built into how the system is set up right now. And I'm not just, you know, I'm not necessarily saying the answer to this is government should pass regulations to change this. But fundamentally, like, I think there's a conflict of interest in companies that provide both content and the pipe. And of course, all of these companies want to do this. Comcast owns NBC. But fundamentally, I think this, if you own both the pipe and the content, of course you're going to want to give preferential treatment to your own in one way or another. And of course you're going to want to sell preferential treatment in different ways. You know, and I don't know the right, if there even is a way to get from here to there without, you know, really onerous overregulation by the government. But look, it seems like fairly clear to me that the ideal from a consumer perspective anyway is that the people who provide the pipe only provide the pipe. They don't do anything else but provide the pipe. And they have, and there's competition there. So there are multiple providers you can pick from at any time so that they can compete against each other on price and quality of delivery and all of that kind of stuff. And most probably the best model on a consumer basis is pay by the byte or the bit, or pay by the bit. It's the more fundamental unit. Because from my point of view, it's great having an unlimited data plan. I guess that's probably best from the consumer point of view too, but it also hides from me the reality of the, you know, I'm actually using more or less or whatever. And it actually, you know, it's good for the big users, and I probably am one, but it hurts the little guys because they're paying way more than they need to in order to subsidize these guys who are sending a lot more. You actually have pay by the bit pricing across the board, you know, set it at a reasonable volume. But I think that's actually fairer for everybody than, you know, all this tiered pricing and weird stuff and, you know, special deals and this combination, and if you buy this too, and I'm not for regulating and saying companies can't come up with creative pricing schemes. I'm just saying if there was true competition here, there would be somebody out there offering the straight by the byte pricing, and lots of people would figure out that's better for them and they'd make out. And the fact that you don't have that kind of competition makes it so that the providers can lock in their pricing plans that are most favorable to them, which is to get people to pay for use things they don't use. And that's what the tiered programs fundamentally do. Yes, they make it so your bill is more regular and, you know, it's always $50. You know, it doesn't depend on how much I use this month. But guess what? Most months you don't use $50 worth of the service if you're an average user. Now, if you're me, you probably use $200 a service for that $50, and so I should just be happy and shut up. But, yeah. And meanwhile, the content providers, go make content. Don't worry about also controlling distribution. And I realize there are all kinds of invested interests because historically, a lot of the money has been made in the distribution part of things. It's not the creators. It's not the people who are the final delivery to you through the internet or whatnot. It's all these middlemen who make the money. It's record labels who package things up and market things and send them out. It's publishers who do this and that. And it's in the case of cable company, it's like the networks and your local stations and these things that they're not necessarily the ones who are creating the content. They hire people to create the content. They make it available. We would be so much better off in a world where all of these middlemen are cut out of the process and you have creators create their content, make it available, and then you can get it through your universal internet delivery mechanism that doesn't give a crap and just cares, is it big or small, and how much, you know, how much bandwidth are you using? And then you'd have people, you know, you'd probably have quality choices where, you know, do you want to buy the next season of your favorite show in super high quality 4K high def, Or is SD okay for you at a quarter of the price and significantly less bandwidth, which you also have to pay for? And people could make those choices. You know, I dream of a world like this, but, you know, getting from here to there, probably not going to happen, because you get the telcos, and I don't know, you can charge the people who provide, you can charge on both ends of it. You can charge the people who are sending the content and the people who are receiving it. They're both using bandwidth. Oh, anyway, the whole thing frustrates me. But it is what it is. I don't know if Comcast Time Warner will go through. If you're arguing it solely based on, you know, competition for consumers and zip codes, it would probably go through without a problem, because, like I say, they don't compete now. But I think there is a larger landscape to consider. Who knows? Maybe it'll be blocked. But I think if government were to get involved with more regulation, the place I think that would be most valuable are twofold. One, get the hell out of the way and let people set up new broadband distribution networks wherever the hell they want. Don't grant these local monopolies, because that stifles so much innovation that could be happening there, and so much consumer-friendly stuff that could be happening. And two, maybe say any one particular company can either do distribution or content, but not both. I don't know. That second seems a little heavy-handed, but they should be organized that way anyway, damn it. I don't know. Nothing's going to happen. And again, I always get conflicted on these things, because, you know, I see the world as I would like it to be. And I'm really tempted by the notion of, well, pass a law and make it that way. And not that you could get any law like that past all of the interests, all of the vested interests involved who are going to lobby against it. But even if you could, the problem is government always screws those things up when they do try to do it. Or they lock in what's good today and don't realize that 3 years from now, it's entirely different and they should change. They lock in and stay that way, and they end up being the one stifling it. So in most cases, you know, the real answer is the first one. Get out of the way. Except, yeah, maybe stop these big guys. I don't know. I am so conflicted. You know, I like, you know, if government is going to be involved, the thing is, it has to be simply involved. It can't be like, I'm going to publish 800 pages of regulations. It has to be more like something like a rule that can be encompassed in a single sentence about what's allowed or what's not allowed. Or, you know, a maximum size for companies. You hit this size, you're automatically broken up. Whatever. Like, but simple. Like, as soon as they get involved and, you know, there's this whole new, there's an agency that his entire existence is involved to regulating this, and there are hundreds and hundreds of regulations, you end up being counterproductive, both because those regulations can't change fast enough to accommodate reality, and second, because you always end up getting this situation where the regulations actually end up advantaging the big guy, because only the big guys can afford to jump through all the hoops. What you need to do is get out of the way so the little guys can compete too and let innovation thrive. Another area you see this in is this conflict right now about the taxi cab type services, where you've got Uber and Lyft and these other guys who are coming up with innovative new approaches here, and they're running into regulatory problems left, right, and center, and cities are trying to shut them down because they're protecting the existing infrastructure of the taxi cab service that is set up in a specific way with licenses that they have to buy and, you know, all these regulations associated with them, whereas these new companies are doing it in a completely different, innovative way that's very consumer friendly. And I understand you want to perhaps get in there with some, you know, minimum safety requirements or whatever, or make sure that the drivers have clean records, whatever. I can understand the logic there, but it seems like the result here is just stifling of innovation, and you can't have that either. So no, I'm not calling for outright government intervention to impose a solution. I just wish that what was evolving in the current state was something a little bit more consumer friendly and a little bit more open to innovation and disruption, whereas a lot of what's going on is existing vested interests protecting themselves and their current profit streams, which fundamentally in the end slows down innovation and hurts the consumer. And yeah, there's a lot of room for government to get out of the way. There's a lot of room, in addition to maybe some very simple high-level government stuff, to keep companies from going nuts. Anyway, I don't know. Again, this is why I'm not a true libertarian, because I'm conflicted about many of these things. Anyway, we'll be back after this, and we'll talk a little bit about what's going on in a whole bunch of different countries that seem to be exploding. Or not so much about what's going on, but why we don't hear as much about it and aren't as familiar. Anyway, back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Hey, I'm back. You know, two things. One, I realized at the beginning of the last segment, I mentioned that I made more changes between the first and second segment on how I was processing the audio. Just to be clear, it's not like changes in what I'm recording. It's changes in the post-processing. So it applied to the first segment too. So there wasn't an audible difference between the first and the second, because the changes I applied to everything. Oh, once again, you don't care. Anyway, in that last segment, I intended to sort of mix in the Facebook WhatsApp thing, but realized I forgot to do so. It is fairly different, of course. I don't know. I have a huge amount to say about this one. If Yvonne was here, he would once again say, you know, $19 billion. Are you out of your mind? How is this worth $19 billion? It's 55 people. Look at all of these other companies that's bigger than, and what do they produce? What money are they making? It's $45 per user, blah, 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 whatever. And you know, Facebook and Google, as we've said, have both been playing fast and loose with money lately. We'll see what they make of it. I guess the argument for this one is that this is a messaging space that, and a mobile space that Facebook has not been as strong in as other areas. WhatsApp is strong in a number of international markets If Facebook's pretty much penetrated anywhere, so I don't know what the overlap is with their existing user base, but they're strong in a lot of overseas markets where other messaging solutions aren't as deeply entrenched, and so it gives Facebook a step up into those areas. Now, what the hell are they going to do with them? I don't know. Is it worth $19 billion? I don't know. As Yvonne says, when are he and I going to come up with the idea that somebody pays us billions of dollars for? I'm guessing never. But, you know, the fact that you see these things happen like that, to me, are an indication that we're once again, sort of like we were in the late 90s, in sort of a crazy time, where people are paying for crazy visions of the future. That there's not necessarily a lot of facts behind, you know, is this thing really going to end up? Now, maybe some of them will, you know, out of all of these things, maybe some will survive and be amazing and wonderful and be worth every cent. But it seems like there are a lot of huge, huge gambles going on with people who have crazy money at their hands and don't know what to do with it. So I guess we'll see. Well, or maybe we're not. Like, I don't know. It's what is there to say? There was also the guy there who won the $425 million lottery in California. good on him, I guess. And good on the people who started up WhatsApp. And that they applied to Facebook for a regular job and didn't get it a few years back. And now look what happened. Okay. Great. But I just think that it means we're in crazy times. That generally indicates at some point there'll be a fall. At some point, all of this will come to a crashing halt when people realize that it's not actually adding up in a way that results in, here's your money. You know, let's move on. I don't have anything else to say about WhatsApp. One more thing. A lot of people were like, what's WhatsApp? I've never heard about it, blah, blah, blah. I actually had heard of WhatsApp. I'd actually loaded it on my phone at one point. I looked at it. I used it, but there were so few of my friends. I don't actually think I ever sent a message with it because I signed up. I let it scan my contacts and let it find who else was using WhatsApp, and it was like basically nobody. And so I don't have it on my phone anymore. I usually will use text messaging if I'm going to do that kind of communication with somebody. It's a little bit more universal, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, enough about WhatsApp. What was going to be next? Oh, yeah. Countries. Countries that are going crazy. We mentioned a few weeks ago, Ukraine, that obviously blew up a little bit more. There was quite a bit of violence, 75 people killed, hundreds injured over the last few days when the government was cracking down on the protests, etc. This morning, in the hours before I'm recording this podcast, there were reports of an agreement between the government and the protesters, elections being called early, reversion to an earlier constitution that gave the government, the president, less power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe Ukraine is going to not spiral into total and utter chaos, and they looked into that abyss and turned around. Maybe. It's still early to tell. We'll see how that goes. Meanwhile, Venezuela has been blowing up. There's protests there that have just spiraled out of control and turned to violence in the last few days, really. I mean, things have been building there for a while, I guess, but have just started to blow up. And this is another one where you know, I'm sure Yvonne would have something to add because he has more familiarity with that region than I do. So I won't say too much. And then also the third one that we hear less about than the other two is Thailand. And there's apparently also stuff going on right there with protests and violence and things happening. And I think the fundamentals of these three that's worth talking about. And it's pretty much the only thing I can talk about because I'm as guilty as anybody else is what I'm about to say, is that the amount of attention to paid to them is remarkably little. I mean, these are three big countries, lots of people there, lots of potential impact from unrest there. In the case of Ukraine, it's in a strategic position between Europe and Russia that has significance. You know, Venezuela is obviously critical to that region as well. Thailand, also, you know, maybe not to the same degree, but is also important to that region. All kinds of stuff going on there. And I know I'm, like I said, I'm just as guilty. I mean, I've sort of looked at the headlines. I've looked at some of the pictures, but I haven't bothered to dive in and understand what's going on. And I know there's the, you know, it's a long way away. How will it affect me directly? But, you know, each of these have potentially major historical impact depending on how things go. There's regions that are significant to the United States. And maybe if everything works out well and the situation sort of resolves itself, then there's nothing to worry about. But in any of these cases, if they spiral out of control, there could be very significant effects globally. But yet it's sort of background. And I mean, I listen to BBC News, and yes, these have been the number one headlines, and yes, they've been talking about it, and yes, there've been, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, if you're just sort of paying attention to news, yeah, you can see a lot of the what happened today. Like in Ukraine, okay, there was a lot of violence in the last couple of days, and then there's a deal, there was a truce, and then the truce fell apart, and you know, the day-to-day stuff is clearly accessible. It's there if you want to look for it. Any major newspaper is going to have it. Even your major sites like CNN have it, although, you know, as usual, those sites are preoccupied by whatever's flashiest at that moment. But what's missing, I think, is sort of the background knowledge. And I understand, like, some of the, like, when Urza Klein left Wonk Blog, his new venture, apparently part of what they're setting up to do, and it'll be a number of months till they'll launch, is a different way of covering things where it doesn't necessarily always concentrate on what happened today, but gives you a place to go to that gives you the big picture. Because I think that's what's missing here. I mean, I have some vague ideas about what's going on in Ukraine. I have even vaguer ideas about what's going on in Venezuela, and barely any idea about what's going on in Thailand. But in any one of those three cases, even if I understand what happened today, I don't come even remotely understanding, like, who are the players? What are the historical forces at play? What is the history behind what happened here? You know, what give me the last 10, 15 years of developments that led us to the place we are today. And I'm sure there are a few places that are trying to do that, that if I went to look to it, I could find. But it's what I feel is the most missing from the overall coverage of that is the, having enough background and knowledge of, you know, what are the issues in the Ukraine? Who are the players? What's going on? Not what's going on today, but just the larger picture. That's just completely missing. Like when Yvonne and I talk about, you know, what's going on between the Republicans and the Democrats and stuff in Congress versus the president and blah, blah, blah. This comes from us paying attention to those type of issues for our entire adult lives and probably some of our childhood, and being embedded in that as something that we hear about all the time and discuss. When something comes up in a far-flung region, we don't have that background. And I think that's a big part of what, you know, would be so helpful for many of these places to do is to do that step back. And I do see some of them trying. Like I'm looking at this very moment in an article on CNN, you know, from flames to fiery opposition, protests rock Ukraine, Venezuela, Thailand, published on February 20th, Thursday, February 20th. And for each one of the locations, they have, what are the protesters' demands? Who's protesting? When did the demonstration start? What's the latest? And it's good to pack it in that way. But even then, it's like it's a few sentences in each one of these. And I feel like I could do with a lot more. But at the same time, having this like punchline with a few sentences each is actually very useful too. Because, okay, let's be honest. Am I going to spend 3 or 4 hours reading all kinds of background information to learn about any one of these three countries? No. I'd like to. I honestly am interested in it, and it's the kind of thing that I would spend time on. But, you know, I got work, I got family, I got things going on. The amount of time I actually have to dedicate to such things is maybe, just in general, to all my news following, is maybe half an hour, 45 minutes a day. On a good day, less on most days. So I'm not going to get a super amount of depth, but it would be useful to see like a lot of this stuff more front and center. And it's completely the opposite trend, because like, you know, we're talking Twitter, and Twitter's all about this very moment. And there was a hijacking of a plane, ended up landing in Switzerland last week, and all kinds of people on Twitter were complaining that, you know, the news broke on Twitter and people were talking about it on Twitter and all kinds of details for an hour, hour and a half before the major international news networks started picking it up, or news sites for that matter, and talking about it. And when they did start talking about it, they started talking about unconfirmed events. And they're like, well, we've known this stuff for an hour. What are you talking about? How are you so far behind? And so it's all very concentrated on this moment and this day. But the stepping back, I think, is important. And if somebody figures out how to do it right, they'll have a market too. And maybe Urza Klein's new venture is going to do it and do it right. I don't know. But I think there is that gap there today, because everything is so today focused. And then on the other hand, of course, you can go to Wikipedia and read, you know, all you want about the history of the Ukraine, but it doesn't do the putting in context today's events against that background. And that's what's missing. And I think there's a big opening there for somebody to do something creative and intelligent with that. Now, I'm not necessarily saying it's a huge moneymaker, then they're going to make billions on it, and it's going to be one of those things I was talking about a few minutes ago, that, you know, Google goes and buys you for $18 billion because you've done this. But I think there is a gap there that would be very helpful, of something to get the non-expert up to speed quickly with what's going on in a region, a country, or with an issue. Just, you know, hey, there have been new developments on the TPP trade deal. Okay, great. There have been new developments on that trade deal. What's the background that makes me understand today's developments in a context that matter? There's a gap there. Somebody needs to fill it. Whoever fills it, I think, whoever fills it and fills it well, will be successful within that arena. But, you know, it can't be, like, I don't think it's ever going to be the CNN or New York Times or, you know, these big guys doing that, because I know what gets the most clicks and the most traffic and the most eyeballs is the hyperventilation about what's new or what's picturesque or what's exploding today. But in the interest of sort of intelligent public discussion, having the other easily available would be so helpful. Somebody please do it. Okay, we'll take a break and we'll come back with a few other odds and ends, and then we'll wrap this sucker up. Back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula? I'm ready. Frankenstein, then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
I'm back and, I should put the microphone in front of me. There we go. Wonder how long that's not been in front of me. Probably just while I was during the break. Anyway, I'm back, and look at this. We're already over an hour long. See what I said about, like, I always say this is going to be a short show, and I wasn't going to do it this time, even though when I started this show, I was like, I can't even imagine I have more than 10 minutes of stuff to talk about. But here I am. We're already over an hour, and we're not done yet. I'll wrap it up pretty quick, because actually in about 10 to 15 minutes, I need to leave. I'm meeting somebody for lunch. But, so what was the last thing we were going to talk about? Late night TV. You know, I haven't watched late night TV in ages. I used to watch Letterman. I used to watch Carson back in the day. I watched a little bit of a few other people. I used to watch Saturday Night Live. I don't watch any of those things anymore. So frankly, the Who Gets the Tonight Show doesn't have a lot of direct effect on me. However, you know, there was one tweet, and I can't remember who said it. Maybe it was Iglesias. I don't know. I don't know who said it. But there was somebody who said in the last week since Jimmy Fallon took over Tonight Show that it looks like most of the late night shows really at this point are simply a mechanism for the construction of viral videos. And I certainly can see that point because, you know, I haven't watched an entire episode of Saturday Night Live in many, many years. It's probably been even longer since I've watched an entire episode of any of the late night shows, Leno or Letterman or Conan or Fallon or any of these guys. However, every time they do something any particularly good, and I guess this goes for like the Daily Show and the Colbert Show too, although I've Colbert Report, although I've watched them more recently, whenever they do anything really good, whenever they do anything really good, somebody tweets about them, somebody shares it on Facebook, somebody posts a link on their blog, and I see it anyway. I click through and I click on and I watch that particular clip. And very often it's nice, it's funny, it's great. And I'm like, I'm glad I saw this. But would I ever record their whole show to watch it, let alone actually watch it live? I don't watch anything live anymore. But no, I'm not going to record their whole show. I figure if anything really good comes out of it, they'll it'll be all over the place and I'll see it. Like, you know, Brian Williams rapping, that was funny. That was funny. Yes, it was. It was great. Seeing Jimmy Fallon's first few moments on The Tonight Show where he mentioned all the previous hosts, that was cool. It wasn't all that funny, but it was cool. It was fun to watch him do that. You know, whenever they come up with something good, it's everywhere. You see it anyway. And so the question is, and I'm clearly like, people like me who don't watch the actual shows probably still aren't the majority, but clearly, like, these shows recognize the power of social media and are leveraging it in a variety of ways. You know, it's no accident that these clips are available and that people tweet it. It's part of their strategy. But I'm not sure in the end it's going to end up getting a lot more people watching their shows. It's going to get lots of people watching those clips. So, you know, you are seeing ads embedded in those clips where you watch the like 15-second ad and then you watch your 2-minute comedy clip or whatever. And that's where we're going. And, you know, earlier in the show, I talked about disintermediation. I think you're going to see that stuff here too. You're already seeing like there are lots of independent YouTubers who put out interesting content, and some of them go viral, and you see them too. And they're small players doing those kinds of things. And by independent small players, I don't necessarily mean one guy, you know, sitting at his computer doing it. Although you've got a few of those as well, but small independent companies that live off creating content and distributing it this way, you're going to see more and more of that. And I don't know if the full-fledged late night show will survive forever. It's certainly not going to disappear anytime soon, and because there certainly are tons of people who do watch the whole shows. But it's just another example of things changing rapidly. Like, I'm never going to watch these late night shows in their entirety. Even if by some reason I was tempted to do so, I'm probably not going to watch the commercials. But will I watch the 15-second commercial followed by the 2-minute funny thing that a bunch of people on my Twitter have said, hey, this is cool, go look at it? Yes, I absolutely will. And I will see that commercial. And if you want me to see that commercial and pay for that, great. And if there's more content like that because you pay for that, awesome. Okay. The one other thing I promised, and this will be relatively short, is an update on my plans for 2016 and, you know, the poll stuff I track and everything along those lines. Those of you who follow me on Twitter have seen that every few weeks I've been doing a little bit more. My strategy all along was, you know, start early. I started early in 2013, in the hopes that by the time we get to Iowa in 2014, I've got everything set up just the way I want to, because, you know, in the past years, I've done most of this in Excel. I've done things manually in Excel. I've copied and then I've taken screenshots of the graphs and I've put them online, and that sort of worked. But especially the last couple months before the election is insane. The amount of effort that I put into it in terms of hours, you know, is sort of devastatingly high. I ended up, you know, the last month before the election, I started taking time off work. I think the last week before the election, I took off entirely from work because I knew that it was a full-time job at that point to keep up. Now, keeping up with the new polls that are coming out is still going to be fairly intensive, but I've been automating. So I've been putting it so that I can just put the raw poll data in a text file, and my graphs and charts and everything are generated automatically. So far, I've got it set up to have state summary pages that have a graph of how the candidate is doing in that state, and a list of the polls, and even older polls. Polls included in my 5-poll average and older polls. Drop downs that let you pick which candidates you're concerned about, because we're not down to a final two candidates, one Republican, one Democrat at this point. But we have, a variety of people who have been polled about. So you can pick your Democrat, pick your Republican, see what the results are in each state. Again, I'm concentrating on state polls because, hey, that's how our elections actually work. And then I also have a national summary page that's built out of that, that shows, okay, given all those states, how did a 5-poll averages end up? Where does that put everybody? If you take all the close states and give them one candidate or the other, what's the range in the Electoral College? And again, you can pick your candidates and all that kind of stuff. Got a lot left to do. All of this is in a temporary location right now. It's not at my real abelsmay.com website. I'll move everything around to be in the right places later. The next few things on my list, I want to do national summaries over time, so you can see how the range of possible outcomes has changed based on how we go in time. One of the things that my analysis has always been is it's never tried to be an outright prediction of what will happen on election day. It's instead always been a snapshot of where things are now. But more than that, I've always shown these historical graphs so that you can see the ups and downs and the ebbs and flows of where people are and what people are thinking and what the polls are saying. Because to me, it's not just interesting as where are we now and where's it going to be in November, but it's also interesting to see these changes and see, oh, something happened and now everybody's moving in this direction, or something else happened and now they're moving in the opposite direction. And it's interesting to watch those changes over time and also sort of the range of those changes. So like, if things move towards the Republicans and to the Democrats and towards the Republicans and to the Democrats, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, but you notice that the actual line of where things stand, despite however much it's got moved back and forth, has always been on the Democrat side of the line, which was the case last time around in 2012. Maybe that means the Democrats are more likely to win, because even when the Republicans have their best weeks, it's still not good enough. Or maybe not, or maybe like more like 2008, you actually saw some back and forth where you were across that winning line. There were weeks where it looked like McCain was going to win. There were weeks when it looked like Obama was going to win. But then all of a sudden, Sarah Palin and the economic crisis happened and things shot in Obama's direction. And at that point, things looked clear. Anyway, the ebbs and flows are interesting too. So I want to put in some graphs on that. I want to make a map. I want to do all of that kind of stuff. I'm working on it when I have time, which typically tends to be, you know, maybe once a month, on a good month, maybe twice a month, but usually like once a month, I get a weekend where I get enough sort of space where I can sit and chug through this for a number of hours. And quite frankly, usually it takes the form of me staying up all night doing it, because that's when I'm most likely out of time. So slowly but surely building things out. I still got a couple years left. And right now, like, the next thing I have on my list is to catch up on polls. Like, I know there are a bunch of polls that are sitting there in my RSS feeds that I've saved. I'll go back and look at these later, or in various searches that I have set up. So I know there have been a number of polls in the last couple months that I don't yet have included. So I want to catch up on doing that next, and then we'll go from there. But it's interesting. There are a lot of polls so far. On a state level, it's still not too many states have enough polls really to be making really good conclusions yet. And of course, we're so many years out. Like, again, this current status has almost no predictive ability on what'll actually happen in 2016. But, and people would argue there's no point at all at looking at this stuff. Nevertheless, lots of people are, and that includes me. And the reason is because while it may not be predictive directly of what happens in 2016, what the polls are saying now does affect who's lining up behind these candidates? How are their organizations building? What kind of fundraising are they going to be able to do? A candidate who's polling at nothing is not going to get a lot of people behind them to raise money and do what they need to do to mount a real campaign in another year and a half. And that process that they call the invisible primary of candidates lining up support and figuring out what they're going to do and deciding whether or not to run in the first place, that started even before the 2012 election. 2012? Yeah, it's 2000. Years are moving into each other. Even before the 2012 election, that process started, and it's in full gear right now. And yes, there are a few candidates trickling in and visiting Iowa and New Hampshire. That's happening, even though they're not official candidates. Oh, they're just visiting Iowa because it's a nice place to visit in the winter. Yeah, right. Anyway, that stuff is happening. And the polls right now may not have that predictive ability towards 2016, but they do start telling you who even has a shot, who's even in the ball game, who's not. They do tell you the state of play today. The state of play today is, Hillary's a strong favorite, not just for the Democratic nomination. And I haven't even started looking at like the tracking I typically do of the primary processes, but also of all of the pairings that have been envisioned so far against various Republicans. All of the Republicans show her in a commanding lead there. There are a couple Republicans that were showing very close. Guess who? There's like Christie and Bush and those folks. We're showing like results. And I'm including here some national polls that were done as well, not just the state polls that I have on my stuff. But, they were showing somewhat close. Christie, since his bridge issues, has dropped way off. So there is a current state of the race. The current state of the race for 2016 is Hillary Clinton is a hands-on favorite. If you were going to bet today on who will be taking the oath of office in January 2017, you should bet on Hillary Clinton. Now, long time. Lots to happen. People haven't even... people have started. What am I saying? People have started to try to dig into the opposition on Hillary and to pull her down and bring up negatives. But nothing compared to what will actually happen once the campaign actually hits. So we got a long way to go. The fact that Hillary's way ahead now does not mean she'll be way ahead in 2016. But it does tell you where do things stand now and what is the... What efforts do what kind of Republicans do better or worse against her? What kind of efforts would they have potentially make to catch up? Where do they have to concentrate? And there are lots of people who are looking even more at demographics and within states and all kinds of stuff like that. And it starts to paint the picture and the contours of what things may look like. And again, you know, even so, there is a lot of validity there, but one big news event, you know, if we have another 9/11 between now and 2016, everything looks completely different. Everything. You know, there are all kinds of other news events that you could imagine that would completely change the landscape of the race. Hillary could decide not to run. You know, there are all kinds of things that could really change things. So, you know, it is early, but I'm trying to get it in place. And you know, I say I'm starting early to try to get everything that I want in place before the Iowa caucuses. But really, I would love it if it was all there already, because there are some insights to be had already. And I think, you know, really things are going to ramp up into high gear right after the 2014 elections at the end of this year. So really, by the time we get to January 2016, from January 2016, actually, who am I saying? From the day after the election in November 2014 through to the election in 2016, the presidential election is going to be the big thing, and there's going to be all kinds of talk about it. So I really want to have things basically in place by then, but we'll see. At the pace I'm making, I may or may not get there in time for that, but soon after. And then, like I said, I haven't even started thinking about what I'm going to do for the primaries. That's also a place that I've done completely manually for Excel in the past, and there I'm not looking at polls. I'm looking at the delegate race, because on the primary side of things, where I've seen people, what frustrates me entirely on the primary process is all these people talking about polls, when in fact, for the primary process, polls don't matter, delegates do. And the fact that, you know, candidate X got 57% in New Hampshire doesn't actually matter. The fact that matters is they got so many delegates in New Hampshire. And how does that reflect where they stand compared to the rest of the race? And so the metric I've concentrated on in the primary races is the percentage of the remaining outstanding delegates that each candidate has to get in order to clinch the nomination from a delegate point of view. And that's very telling. And looking at that number, for instance, back in 2008, made it absolutely clear that Obama had an insurmountable lead months before people stopped talking about the battle between him and Hillary. Yeah, it was just Hillary catching up was an impossible ask, absent, and again, you always have to say these things, absent something catastrophic happening to Obama. And I'm not necessarily talking about physically. I'm, you know, something major that suddenly destroys his entire reputation and lets Hillary, you know, take 100% of the remaining delegates or something like that. It wasn't actually quite that dramatic as 100%. That's only once you clinch. But anyway, I want to do some automation there too. But that process, frankly, was a lot less onerous than the process of tracking the polls in the month up to election day. So I'm concentrating on it's 20 hours according to my computer. It was much less onerous than the process of tracking the polls in the last month to election. So I if I needed to do the primary process manually again, I can do the primary process manually again. It's not that big a deal. But I'd like to do some automation there too. It would be nice. But I'm only going to touch that once I finish the general election stuff, because getting the general election stuff all automated is going to make much bigger difference to me. Anyway, I think we're done here. We've gone way too long. You know, solo show with Yvonne doesn't matter. We still go almost an hour and a half, like routinely. Sorry, guys. For those of you who like short shows, what can I tell you? Play the show on double speed. Anyway, that's it. Thanks a lot for listening to us. As usual, you know how to get in touch with me. Email me at ablesme@ablesme.com. That's ABULSME. Or contact me at Twitter @ablesme. And Yvonne is at I am Bo. He's not here this week, but you can still tweet him. He still needs Twitter followers. So follow him on Twitter if you haven't already. And, share us, review us on social media, all that stuff too. Give us reviews on the iTunes store. That helps too. And that's what I've heard anyway. The only person who's ever reviewed us on iTunes is still Yvonne, as far as I know, although I haven't looked lately, so who knows. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Have a good week. We'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.